You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Good morning, gardeners far and wide. I hope you're starting your pruning and have been weeding happily. Today, I'm here, Virginia Hayward, and with me is John Arnott, horticultural consultant, ex-the zoo, Geelong Botanic Gardens, Cranbourne Botanic Gardens, Begans, still working with Burrendong Botanic Gardens, Stephen Ryan, Dicksonia Rare Plants, patron Geelong Botanic Gardens and the RHSV, president of Plant Trust, a myriad of media roles, and a brilliant horticulturalist, which you must find, and Claire Farrell, associate professor and director of Melbourne University Botanic Gardens, where she's been for 16 years and has become famous for her woody meadow. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. How are you going?
So, what have we been doing? John, what have you been doing?
Oh, I spent the entire day in the garden yesterday. It's taken me a little while to do this, but when we first moved into our little garden in Bond Beach, I decided that I would go with an inorganic mulch because I thought it looked kind of good, but it was completely form over function. So I've been pulling up the gravel and going to be putting some organic mulch back down onto this sandy soil this afternoon.
Yes, because organic mulch will actually, over the years, really improve that sandy soil.
Yeah, for sure.
Stones won't.
Yeah.
All stones do is ruin any wood in the house when it gets caught in your shoes.
Yeah, I don't know why I went with it. It just sort of seemed like the thing to do. I was trying to emulate a little bit of the cranbourne garden. And you know, it
couldn't let go, huh?
I couldn't let go. I could not. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, crushed rush. Yeah, it's sort of like quartzy. Yeah, I mean, it looked great.
Looks great, but as I said, it gets stuck in your shoes and ruins the floor.
Yeah, and down the side we did it conventionally with organic mulch, and the plant performance it's chalk and cheese between the two. So, yes, getting back to some first principle gardening. And
it's one of Craig's things that he's put about 5 foot of mulch on his garden over 20 years, and it's just changed the value of the soil.
Yeah,
Craig's, not that his has ever been bad.
Craig's he's a big mulcher, isn't he? He's a big organic mulcher.
I'm up there too. I once had a friend say that we put the second story on our house because the first one was disappearing under the mulch. So I've been a serial mulcher for a long time, I have to say.
It just makes a whole lot of sense. You know, it suppresses weeds, it conditions the soil, cools us all down.
The only thing I think is negative about it is it does make it difficult for things to seed themselves in the garden.
Yes, you can lose a lot of self-seeders with nice thick mulch.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
It is one of the drawbacks, but there's not many of them.
Yes. Yeah.
You just need a gravel path next to your garden.
Yeah, and then they all come up in that, yes.
I've got a sawdust path and things come up really well in that sawdust. It's great.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Hey? I love
a
sawdust.
Like a propagation bench.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
In fact, it's amazing what things will self-seed themselves in your garden that you struggle to actually raise under normal propagating situations. Mm.
The red sand garden at Cranbourne, that was perceived when it was first designed to be a low maintenance because it didn't have, you know, mulch beds or anything like that.
Wow.
But it was just this huge, great big seed bed for annual grasses and a whole bunch of stuff.
Do you think they'll ever rethink that design?
No, that's there in perpetuity. Yeah. It's the signature of the Australian gardens is to kind of walk in and be immersed in this, null arbor landscape with all the colours and tones of inland Australia. No, that'll be there forever.
Right.
But it's interesting, like we used to put on gallons and gallons and gallons of herbicide in order to manage the weeds. Yeah. And we're starting to get herbicide resistance and
of course.
You know, all that stuff Yeah, of course. Yeah. But in the end, what we're using a cultural practice, but it's a bit like a bagging net on a tennis court, but it just scarifies the surface up. And all of the weeds which are germinating on the surface. It's like a Dutch hoe.
Yeah.
It's like a Dutch hoe. You just, like, so we're hoeing them, exposing them to the conditions, and they shrivel up and die. We haven't used herbicide for a long, long time since.
What a good story.
Yeah. Just by, you know, mechanically.
By finding another way of doing it.
Yeah. So it's a bit like a giant Dutch hoe.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, even with woody meadows, because we plant into crushed scoria or limestone, depending where we are.
Yeah.
And everyone thinks, how the hell is plants growing into that? But, you know, they do love it, but you need canopy coverage quickly so you don't have the weeds.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, so yep, yeah. So I'm mulching. I'm actually using some organic mulch, which would be good.
All right.
And what about you, Stephen? What have you been doing?
Not a lot, because I don't know that it matters if I tell everybody, but I've just recently been having an operation, so I've been trying to recoup.
Mm. How's the recovery going?
Look, it's pretty good, really. Yeah. I mean, I got an infection as well, which carried the thing on for a lot longer, but I'm getting back to normal now, and so the garden is suffering the consequences as we speak, because...
Well, it's also choosing... to move, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, my garden's moving beautifully.
Yeah. Yeah, well, everything
which
is
all the weeds
on the
are doing
way.
Very well,
oh,
therefore.
Gawks, yes, the petty spurge and the sticky weed and God knows what else that's popping up everywhere, the winter grass, all that sort of stuff. And so at the moment I'm just looking at it. But over the next few days, I'm hoping I'll start to get in there and start manually clearing up some of the areas and make them look a bit tidier before I go away.
Yes.
Because I'm off again.
I know. And Madagascar, which is such a wonderful venue.
Fabulous. So I haven't been back to Madagascar since before COVID. So I'm really
Which is when I went with you.
I think it was.
That was
indeed.
My first ever trip.
Mm. Yeah, right.
I loved it.
Yeah. It's a great place.
What an amazing flora.
Oh, and the fauna,
of course. And the fauna,
The fauna's totally superb.
Yeah, and I love the fact that you go out and look for animals. Here, if you're looking for a damn koala for an international visitor, you can hunt for hours and you can't find one. Over there, the lemurs and things come down to look at you. So you can virtually guarantee animal sightings. And, of course, they have one of the world's most incredibly diverse and bizarre floras.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got one... baobab tree in northern Australia. There's one in South Africa, and I think there's seven in Madagascar. So, I mean, it's just the most remarkable flora.
And it's also one of those places I wouldn't go on my own.
Yeah, you're better to go on an organised tour.
Yeah, because it's very poor and it's big. So to actually get around it, as a tour, we had some beauties like planes disappearing and things like that.
Well, as in not leaving. Yeah, okay. They didn't actually completely disappear.
No.
They were still there somewhere. They cancelled the odd flight.
Yeah,
that makes it sound a little more benign. it's one of those places. I mean, I did Madagascar back in the mid-90s as an independent tourist. And back then they didn't even have landlines between the cities and there was no mobile phone coverage. So you couldn't even book ahead.
Yeah,
you just had to drive to the next town or city and hope like mad you'd find somewhere to stay. And it was a serious adventure holiday. But it's what started me in tour leading because I'd been there. Somebody knew about it and they had a tour ready to go to Madagascar. And they said, well, I'd be prepared to lead it.
Mm.
And I thought, well, how hard can it be?
Quite hard.
Yes, it can be quite hard. But, yeah, so, I'm looking forward to it. So we leave on the 6th, so it's only less than 3 weeks away now.
So you're going to have to be careful of your leg while you're away.
Well, I'm going to make sure it's still under me anyway. I'm sure it'll be fine. I mean, I did take a tour to Madagascar years ago, not terribly long after having broken my ankle, and I was still on a crutch just for balance mainly, and here's the tour leader on a crutch going around in the forests of Madagascar. So don't let many things stop me, really. So it'll be fine. We've got a fully booked tour, and they're all excited to go, and several of them are people I've travelled with before, which is nice.
Nice.
It's always... It's always gratifying when somebody else books onto or somebody books onto a tour that you're doing that you travel with before because it means they must have thought the job you did last time was half reasonable. So I always like that.
That's good. Mm. Have many Madagascan plants made it into cultivation in temperate Australia?
Not as many as you would have hoped. I mean, some iconic plants like Aloardias, the Didaraceae stuff, they're very popular amongst succulent and cacti collectors. Yeah. So some of them have made it in. And actually in the highlands of Madagascar, there's quite a number of plants that aren't strictly speaking tropical that would actually be quite serviceable. But certainly the cacti and succulent side of things certainly did, because they've got lots of aloes, pacopodiums, all that sort of
arborescent succulents, like tree-shaped things.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff has made it in. But there's oodles of other flora there that we don't see. I mean, they've got gesneriads and begonias and orchids of all sorts. Yeah. I mean, some of their orchids are absolutely outrageous.
They are, and there's so many things there that are just so rare and unusual.
And unfortunately, some of them getting rarer and more unusual.
Mm. Unfortunately.
Sadly, but anyhow. Yeah. It's still a place well worth visiting, and some of the national parks are just mind-blowing. So I'm looking forward to get back.
And Claire, do you have a garden at home?
I do have a garden. It's not a super big one because it's a little Edwardian single-fronted cottage, but it has a front yard and a backyard. And basically my mission at the moment is to put as many different types of plants in it as I can. Mm. So if it's not a goer and it's not doing well, something else takes its place because it's just not enough room.
where do you see many plants are the product of production that happens at Burnley? Like, have you got... So you've got access to some interesting, unusual things.
I think that's the perk of the job, isn't it? Leftover from an experiment. Needs a home. Really, really good.
I had a really small garden in London, and I think it's a really good training for you because, I mean, now my garden's, 5 or 6 acres, so I can just, I'll have that. I can put it, there'll be somewhere. Whereas I had to be so much more specific if I wanted the garden to look good.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we have a green wall for that reason that we did with half-hanging baskets. And we've been converting downpipes into rain gardens as well, which is because there's not really enough room for any tanks and storage. So it's like, how do we make the most of the rainfall runoff and grow plants with it?
Yeah, that's a good thing. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's what's the mechanism? Just intercept the groundwater?
No, it's downpipes going into, the bottom of wicking beds, essentially, if you want to think about it like that. And then the one set of wicking beds basically form our balustrade on a deck. And then that's got lattice screens so we can grow herbs without the possums eating it all. So it's a bit of a win-win.
Yes, because the possums can be a touch challenging. It's odd. They don't bother me in Seville. I don't know why.
Blessed.
But they do round here in Fitzroy. They're in my daughter's garden. She's got brushies and she's got possums, possums. And they're beautiful, but they're slightly problematic for bits of the garden.
Yeah, I think this time of the year is the worst. Like, they're even on our bay tree now, which they left alone last year.
Bay tree.
Wow. And, you know...
Well, they'll be self-marinated.
We did joke that.
Dear.
I don't know about that.
Actually, speaking of small space gardens, on Thursday this week I was in a garden in Preston that belongs to a reasonably well-known landscape designer, Michael Wright from Rush Wright and Associates. And Michael's garden is more or less a large courtyard, but it's beside the house. It's not behind the house. And he has got no sense of keeping things small in a small space.
Yeah.
And he's a great example of that, because I get customers that come in, I've only got a tiny garden, so they want things that are
diminutive plants.
You know, so they put in these pointless little nothings. Michael's got an enormous ficus in his garden that he trims the top out of.
The Mexican chalice vine?
Across the front of the house, he's got the Cilandra maxima growing all the way across
Is that the yellow one?
Yeah, the huge big yellow thing.
Fabulous.
And he's got that growing all the way across the front of the house, and there's a sort of a brick wall that's the front of the courtyard garden between there and what was a garage but is now a studio. And he's run it across the top of that as well. And he's got monsteras, he's got dorianthuses, he's got all these enormous plants, but all in a really, he's got Dendrocalamus bamboo that's about 10 metres tall, growing all the way along the side of the wall of the house to keep the heat off the wall of the house. And you walk into it and it is this most enclosing and gorgeous space, and it just proves you don't have to go little because you've got a little garden.
Well, my garden in London, it was really quite small, but it backed onto an abandoned cemetery.
Yeah, right.
So I had these huge things behind me. So to put little things in the garden was just asking for failure.
Yeah, for sure.
And so it was the same. And we had this huge wall. There were so many dead bodies behind us. The cemetery had built up, you know.
A bit like Stephen's mulch.
Yes.
Exactly. So we just had to put some big things in.
Yeah.
It did make a difference.
And it's surprising, big plants in a small space can actually still make the space look inviting and not small.
No.
You know, it really can. I mean, this courtyard's even got a small swimming pool in it.
Yeah,
so you're talking about fairly restrictive spaces.
Yeah.
And when Michael and his wife bought it, it had twee little box hedges and clipped ficus balls and, you know.
Iceberg roses, probably.
Yeah, probably. I don't know. He didn't mention iceberg roses. But he got rid of all that clobber and now it's this tropical sort of oasis. It's just fabulous. So we filmed there all morning on Thursday to put together a story for our YouTube channel.
Awesome.
And I think it's going to be really good. And it should explain to people that, you don't have to think small because you're in a little space.
And just give us the name of your YouTube channel.
Oh, The Haughty Culturalists. So anybody can find it. You just go into your YouTube finder and type in The Haughty Culturalists and we should come up. And every Friday a new story comes up. We did one last week in Castlemaine.
Oh, nice.
Garden in Castlemaine. It's on a steep, rocky slope. There's no soil at all.
No soil.
No topsoil at all.
Who needs topsoil?
Who needs topsoil?
We do.
And Alice bought this with her partner, and it's about 3/4 acre. And she's created this lush, mainly succulent garden and with lots of tubs made out of old copper inserts from hot water services her partner's really good at making things, because I always have this fear of recycled stuff in gardens because, you know, a toaster planted with succulents still looks like a toaster. And so, you know, you can take things too far. But Alice's partner has got a real eye, and he even has his own recipe to get verdigris going on the copper.
Oh, beautiful. Oh,
and nice. Apparently part of the recipe is Heinz tomato soup. I assume the acids in the soup help create that green verdigris look. And it was fantastic. It's just the most fabulous garden.
Oh, I must have a look.
That sounds exciting. Was this last Friday's. And next Friday we're doing part two, where we're doing a whole story on her chicken run.
Nice.
Which is a garden in its own right. It's just fabulous.
Well, that's wonderful. John making the zoo be a garden.
Yeah. Very good idea.
So I love getting into gardens that are a bit quirky and different like that. Mm. And they're great fun. And Alice turned out to be fantastic talent as well. So.
Awesome. That just sort of inner urban greening thing, you don't think of big, bold plants in that context. That's a thing.
It is a thing, and I think the other bit that's exciting about it is it makes you problem solve with plants you might not play with, you know, like all of a sudden you've got a shade problem. So you read about woodland plants, you know. My students are teasing me. They're like, Claire, you're going through your English garden phase.
A certain amount of contempt, some of them.
Oh, no, with love. With love. Yeah, but definitely this year's the first time I've ever really played with bulbs, and I went all out and maxed out this little bed underneath an acer, and coming home every night and seeing, you know, daffodils and snowdrops and all of that kind of thing, you can't help smile.
Oh, look, it's wonderful. My daffs are out, and I had to take out I had a dry creek bed, and it was a bit like the red bit. The only way I could cope with it was spraying it. I could not keep the weeds out of it.
Yeah.
And so I thought, oh, this is hopeless. I can't keep spraying this. It'll just have to go. So I moved all the stones at exactly the same time as I decided stones were the only way to get rid of the rabbits under the house, which I successfully did.
Oh, you moved stones to
and blocked all their access to under my bedroom. Unfortunately, with a few of them in there, but nevertheless.
Oh, dear.
It was a bit of an oh, dear. But I then, just because it was manky, I just planted daffodils. I went round to Tesselaar's and had a chat to them and just planted daffodils right down. And it just at the moment looked, because you can see that it's a creek bed, and it just looks fantastic.
Spectacular.
Beautiful. I love them. And in parts of my garden that are close to the house, I've put the miniature daffs in. Oh, God, I love those miniature daffs.
They're cute.
They're cheery, aren't
they? Oh, they're so cheery. Yeah. And in my garden, I love things that are dormant in summer because I don't have to worry about them.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, summer dormancy is a great thing.
Oh, it's wonderful. I've got the Veltimias up. I've got the daffodils up. I've got so many things up that just will disappear. It's a wonderful thing, I think, yes.
Yeah.
And, of course, you've been working on woody gardens. Can you explain
what the woody meadows is? Yes, so woody meadows, dense plantings of Australian trees and shrubs that are managed by coppicing. So hard pruning down to about 20 centimetres every 2 to 4 years to get really good canopy coverage, but importantly, lots and lots of flowers. So they're designed to replace Lamandra land, essentially.
Oh,
so
thank God for that.
I know, right?
I'm glad somebody's doing it.
And, you know, it's been really gratifying because Woody Meadows, like as a project, you know, they're 10 years old now, and we've been able to show they cost the same to input as Lamandra land, but their maintenance over time is 75% less.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah, really. Wow. Which is amazing because Lamandra land, they actually maintain it very regularly. You know, we're talking quarterly, they'll go and do edges or they'll pick out rubbish and all of those kind of things. And Woody Meadows, you leave them for 2 years and you come and chop them.
You chop the whole thing at once.
Chop the whole thing at once. But we have been designing models more recently where maybe you go and cut half of it in 1 year and half the next.
Yeah.
So, I mean, really the key to them, other than being coppiced and Australian plants, you can do whatever you want with them. So you can have them in a roundabout or you can have a large planting on a freeway. You just play with your plant selection. And our next thing is playing with them for water-sensitive urban design, so thinking about taking over rain gardens and swales and all of those monoculture plantings with this. So that's the next space. But our guidelines are published online and they're free. They've been downloaded an insane amount of time since we've released them.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, 12,000 people have downloaded Woody Meadow guidelines since November.
So if they just put in Woody Meadows, do they find it?
Yep, they'll find it.
Because the Woody Meadow outside Burnley, and you can go and look at it, everybody, if you just, you don't even have to go into Burnley, it's actually there. You're on the road, behind you is the river, and there is the Woody Meadow at the gate. And it's fantastic. It just looks fabulous.
Thanks, Virginia. Yeah, we're pretty proud of it. And I think that's the thing.
And you won't cut that all at once, will you?
Well, we're actually going to do it in two phases because we have our Discovery Day coming up. And so we're going to chop, because there's two beds either side of the entrance roadway. So we're going to chop one before Discovery Day so people can see what it looks like when it's coppiced, and we're going to leave the other one. So it's going to be a bit instructional, and I'll probably do a bit of coppicing on the day as well, because even though everyone hears about Woody Meadows and they go, oh, that sounds logical, coppicing, yeah, I get that, it's all good. When it comes to it, they nearly always need their hand held and to go, look, you have to be brutal and it's going to be okay.
Well, when you say brutal, like part of the design is that you could use a flail mower or a forestry mulcher.
Yeah, absolutely.
And literally just cut it down with a machine.
Yeah, and that's, I guess that's the thing. So at its onset, Woody Meadows were about being low maintenance. So the model of the lowest maintenance was a freeway planting where someone will just drive over it, essentially. Yeah. So that's kind of where we worked backwards from.
Well, I think it looks fabulous. In fact, I must come and have a look because I haven't looked at it for a while. And it fits, you know, because Burnley, it's one of the oldest gardens. How old is it? It's the second oldest, oldest garden?
I mean, I think it's around 200 years for the whole garden, but as a horticultural teaching institution, this year is Burnley's 135th anniversary of continuous horticultural education, which that word continuous means we're the longest in the whole wide world, which is very exciting.
That's a claim.
Yes, a great claim. Fame.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And you go to Burnley and the garden is really, it's really very beautiful. And it's old. I mean, there are old trees, but it is also very interesting, which is obviously partly because it's a research institution, etc. But then out the front, you've got this quite different idea, which is new and brilliant. And the fact that things can change and develop, I mean, it makes it exciting, I think. It makes it an exciting garden.
It is. And we call it one of our living labs because it is that connection to research, and we use it for teaching and extension. But the gardens were always that. So at their outset, the Horticultural Society set it up as an experimental garden. And so there's other things like the Burnley green roofs, and I'm sure everyone's seen those beautiful images with the red and the rooftop garden. But, yeah, the idea with Burnley is that it should be showcasing current practices and,
sure. And new ideas.
New ideas, yeah. Exactly.
And this is making a new idea.
That's right.
Which yeah. is even better.
It is. And I'm finding it really interesting at the moment because there are a lot of people coming from England to come and have a look at Woody Meadows and thinking about how they can use shrubs a bit more in their landscapes. So that's an exciting change.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, can I ask you a question on this? My Indigophoras, I've got a few of them around, are all just coming into flower. And would it be good for me to just coppice them, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. A coppiced Indigophora is the most stunning plant. It turns it into this vase of flowers, basically. And you can go really hard. So even we recommend if you buy tube stop Indigophora, which are the saddest looking things in the world, if you take off their heads, they'll re-sprout and become like a, you know, a vase of flowers. And at home, I had a couple that I'd planted in a sort of mixed border. And it was, you know, not doing great because it was overshadowed. So I was like, oh, I'm going to cut it back really hard and just see if it comes back, great. If it doesn't, what, you know, I have lost nothing. And so I took it down to 15 centimetres and it's resprouted beautifully. Yeah.
And so, you're right, Indigophoras are sad in the nursery. They don't look wonderful.
There's a few plants out in the world like that, unfortunately. Yeah. You've got to be a really good talker to get people to buy some things.
I reckon 70% of your lines.
You try and sell somebody a cantua, you know, the sacred flower of the Incas.
Which remarkable is so beautiful.
Beautiful flowers, but it's this scruffy sort of sticky thing in a pot.
And it is in the garden, but it's still
yeah,
worth
but when
having.
It's in flower, it's stunning. But as a young plant in a 15-centimetre pot, you've got two sort of floppy bits that sit in the pot, and there's no way you can turn that into a bushy or sort of verdant looking plant. It just is the way it is.
Yeah.
No, those bench that whole bench readiness and things that'll display properties in a 6-inch pot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just dumbed down the
well, in
the,
Europe
the
and North America, everything is bred to be grown as a plant they can sell in bloom, and disposable. You know, so you see petunias that are being bred to these really dense things that are just this ball of flowers without a leaf being seen. And I can't think of anything more obscene than to look at something like that.
And that's the lovely thing about specialist nurseries like yours and, you know, that whole cohort of people that are growing interesting plants. They don't necessarily present well in a 6-inch pot. And that's a good thing. Mm. It's a good thing that people are...
Well, people have to realise.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the 3CR Garden Show. I hope you're enjoying listening to us this morning, and we have just had our first message in, which is David from Upway. Hello, David. I would love some advice about Canarina canariensis conditions and climbing nature. Also, Stephen, I'm looking forward to you explaining the tautology similar being renamed Sichophragma.
Oh, yes. all right, Canarina canariensis. I was actually in the Botanic Gardens on Thursday.
They've got two in there.
Yeah, there's a couple of them down in the grey beds, which were the silver borders once upon a time and were mainly Canary Island plants to start with, but they've sort of pushed it out to a whole pile of grey plants from everywhere. And there's a couple of Canarinas flowering down there. And, yes, it is tautology because Canarina means it's from the canaries, and its species name is canariensis, which means it's from the canaries. and I think it was a lost opportunity, actually, to add something into the mix of its name.
Yeah.
But it's a campanulaceous thing with these big orange bell flowers on it. And it's a scrambler. It will loll itself over and sort of scramble up through other plants. It's winter growing, which I think is fabulous. And again, summer dormant.
Yep.
So it's another one of those plants that dies down in the summer. It has a tuberous root system under it, a bit like a dahlia to look at. And the foliage is greyish green. It seems to vary from seedling to seedling a bit. It is slightly frost tender. So some years it doesn't do well for me. It gets frosted down just before it flowers. But I've actually got it in flower at the nursery at the moment looking, well, it's looking splendid, except I stupidly grew it up through an orange and yellow abutilon, and they're both flowering together, which means that you can't really sort of differentiate. You know, there's too much similarity going on. And so it wasn't probably the best idea I've ever had. But anyhow, it's growing quite well. Apparently the fruit are edible.
Yes.
I've never had mine fruit because they always seem to die down before they
I've got a
ripen.
Lot of fruit this year.
Oh, good. You can save me some seed.
Okay.
and it's a fabulous plant. In fact, herbaceous perennial climbers, we have a dearth of. We need more of them because you can grow them over other plants and they don't swamp things because they have a finite size they can grow to in every growing season. Mm. So they can only
get
so
big. And then they disappear.
And then they disappear again. Mm. So you can use them either to complement something that's already in flower, or you can use them to flower when something else is not flowering so that you get double value out of the one space. And really, they'll cope with semi-shade through to full sun. But, yeah, frost is the biggest enemy of Canarina.
Well, I've got four or five in my garden, and I think they are just absolutely beautiful at the moment. And
we want
one
some of
them,
the others. You know there's more species, don't
you? Yeah. Well, one of mine, though, is quite a deep red. It's not an orange red, a purple red, but it's quite a different colour to the other one. So
yeah,
I'm pleased about that. Well, I mentioned it to Jane, Jane Tonkin from Tonkin Bulbs, and she said that. She said there's a real variation in the colour.
Yeah, you can. But yes, we've got to get the one from, I think it's Ethiopia or sort of central northern Africa. There's a Canarina up there, and it has a more open bell-shaped flower, and it tends to be more yellow with red stripes.
Ooh,
I want to desperately.
Yes,
it's probably even more frost tender, unfortunately, so I probably won't be able to grow the damn thing even if I can get some seed.
Is the fruit, is it papery, the fruit, like a papery thing?
No, it's not.
No, it's a sort of fleshy thing.
It's a bit like a berry.
And I'm not going to eat it because I want every single seed because I've got a lot of seed this year and it's very hard to find.
Yeah, it's a great plant. So anyhow, I hope that gives a bit of information on Canarina. There was something else he asked about, wasn't there?
Schizophragma.
Oh, schizophragma. Yeah, gone. Doesn't exist anymore. Because all the schizophragmas, the pilastegias, and the decamerias are now all hydrangea.
They're all hydrangeas.
Oh,
so
wow.
They've all been sunk into hydrangea, which I think is actually very sensible. I'm actually quite pleased about that. It was also when they sunk all of the other things into magnolia. So
Mycelias
and all those other genera that they had erected over the centuries, they're all now magnolia, which is fantastic because you don't have to think twice. It's got a magnolia-like flower, so it must be a magnolia. So it makes logical sense. It's when they split genera up and I can't tell the difference. That's when I start getting annoyed. So
the first thing David said was, "Morning, lovelies. I've just finished reading Wonder About the RBGV and loved reading about Millie and Salvia Meg, amongst others."
Salvia Meg.
Salvia Meg. Yeah, well, we all love Salvia Meg. She's wonderful.
So that's Meg Bentley.
Meg Bentley. And her Salvia book is absolutely, absolutely fabulous.
Yeah.
And you can get it from the Friends office at the RBGV.
I think Meg's the only volunteer that walks around the
She's
RBGV
the only volunteer allowed
with
to.
With a uniform.
And, well, she's the only one allowed to work in the gardens.
Mm.
Nobody else is.
Well, that's because she knows more than the staff, especially on her specific subject.
Yes. Yeah. So. No, she's really good for the gardens, no doubt about that.
Yeah, great supporter of the
gardens. The joke was hydrangea hydrangeoides.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, that was schizophragma hydrangeoides. And, of course, when they changed the genus name, they generally try and settle for the same species name because there's a little sense of continuity there. And they only change it if there's already one with the same species name within the new genus setup. So unfortunately, something that was called a schizophragma that looked like a hydrangea is now a hydrangea that looks like a hydrangea.
A bit like naming a Canary Island bellflower Canary Island, Canary Island.
Yes, the horticultural tautology is quite interesting, and I get lots of people who look at me twice when I say, "Oh, I've got some nice plants of hydrangea, hydrangeoides over there." But you know, it's what it is, and it does make sense. And I'm very pleased the schizophragmas have disappeared into hydrangea because I can spell it easier.
Absolutely. We have another message from Peter and Vicky. We have two special Madagascan trees, a 10 metre by 6 metre dombaya that is at present about 30% in flower. It was planted about 20 years ago. Last October we planted, I cheated on the first one and didn't give it its second name. The first one was Dombaya cacuminum. And they have now planted a Dombaya wallichii. Mm-hmm. And much to their surprise, it's already flowering.
Oh, well done. Yeah, some of the South, the Madagascan Dombayas are just outrageously beautiful.
Yeah.
And I don't know enough about them to pick out what species, but there's one they've got there that has humongous heads of baby pink flowers on it that are just beautiful. And these big mallow-like leaves.
Sparmania-like.
Like a Sparmania. Yeah. The only one I've ever been able to grow at Macedon was Dombaya natalensis. It seemed to be reasonably cold hardy. I've never managed to grow any of the others. But then I can grow lots of other things that other people can't, so I have to be happy.
Dombaya natalensis, beautiful.
Oh, it's a lovely thing.
Like white, pure white flowers.
Yeah. The only problem with it is they go brown. And they don't drop off.
Down. They do go down.
Yeah, and a lot of the Dombayas do that. They have these fabulous flowers, but when the flowers die, they hang on the plant looking dead.
Like some of the camellias.
Like some of the camellias. Mm.
Yeah.
I've got rid of those camellias. I mean, I've got about, 20 camellias in the garden, and I decided I just don't need
The ones that shed
those.
Their flowers as they go over are the ones that you really want. I know with cannas, they've been trying to breed over the years, cannas that are self-cleaning.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, because cannas are really messy.
Yeah, they can look messy when they've got their dead
and
flowers.
And you can't get rid of them once you put them in. They're there for eternity.
Gardeners are worrisome people. I mean, they whinge if they can't grow something and then they whinge if they can.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And I actually think, I mean, in terms of small gardens, cannas bang for your buck. Mine haven't even died completely back this year, which, maybe is a bad thing. But they're such structure and glamour.
They're really vertical too, so they don't take up as much ground room as their height so that they can...
Most of them spread.
Well, yeah, but you can dig out. You can divide them regularly.
And give it to your friends.
That's right, exactly. I'm very fond of them. I think they're a great group of plants.
A lot of mine end up in the green bin, I'm afraid.
Oh, well. Enough is enough.
Yeah. This is the 3CR Garden Show, and I think what I'd like to do now is just read out to you the various things that are coming up. Can I suggest that some of you get a pen and paper? Because I've got quite a long list and I'm just going to shoot through it because I don't want to do nothing but read this list. So the first thing on our list is the Tesselaar Tulip Festival. Now, before I do this, I might just announce our phone numbers because we've got a couple of free tickets available. So our phone numbers are 249419 8377. Or 94190155. Tesselaar Tulip Festival. It runs from September the 12th to October the 11th. It's Mombulk Road in Sylvan. It's absolutely a spectacular place to visit, and it's running for a month, so that's pretty good. And we've got 3 double passes to give away for that.
Okay.
And that's on from September the 12th to October the 11th. The Clivia Show. Or the Clivia Show. I knew they were going to come back at me. We talked about this earlier. Two of us say Clivia and two of us say Clivia. Obviously, Clivia is right because it's named after Lady Clive, but if you started the other way a long time ago, it makes...
It's always the problem once you've got a pronunciation in your head.
Yep, that's it stays there.
You know, I try and be as pedantic about plant names as I can, but there are some I just stumble back into my old way of pronouncing it, even though I know it's probably not the correct way of doing it.
But also clematis and clematis, I don't think there is a right way, is there? I'm a clematis girl.
I'm a clematis.
Yeah, I'm clematis
guy.
As well.
I say clematis, and I can remember being on this very program years ago, and I was talking about that very genus, and somebody from the town thereof rang in and told me off for mispronouncing their town name.
You got it wrong.
Because they came from clematis.
But it wasn't named after that town.
So I don't know how you deal with some of those things, but anyhow, I say clematis.
Brachykaiden, well, brachykaeton.
Oh, really? Oh, I haven't heard of that one.
No, neither have I.
Mm. Oh, I don't like that. Well, back to the Clivia show. That is on September the 19th from 10 till 3 at the Burwood East Uniting Church, and we've got two free double passes for that. So that's September the 19th. The next one on my list is the Bolabek Garden Fair. That's October 3rd and 4th. 10 till 4 at Mount Macedon. The next is the Cranbourne Friends Plant Sale, which starts at 10 and doesn't start before 10, no matter how much you want it to. And it's on from October the 10th and the 11th. The Gippsland Rare and Unusual Plant Fair is October the 10th in Broughton Hall at Jindavik. Broughton Hall is a very lovely garden, which you get as well, a walk around that garden. The Melbourne Botanic Gardens Friends Plant Sale is October the 17th to the 18th. So that's, that's two excellent plant sales. Then we've got the Plant Trust AGM on October the 21st, which is a Wednesday, where Stephen will be running an absolutely wonderful plant auction. It's one of our main fundraising events.
Yes, it is. So.
And it's really, really good fun.
Yes, and I'll get as much money out of people as I
possibly can. Yes, and we have really unusual plants. It's one of the things that's so good about it. Then, oh dear, I've got this terrible itch in my throat. I'm really sorry, people. Then I've got the Upper Yarra Valley Open Garden Weekend, November the 7th and 8th, which is mostly in Warburton. And that same weekend, the Yarra Valley Plant Fair, both the 7th and the 8th, which is in Wandon, which is on the Warburton Highway. So November 7th and the 8th is an exciting time to be on the Warburton Highway.
Mm, certainly.
And then, Claire, there's some Burnley.
Yeah, we have the Burnley Campus Discovery Day on Saturday the 24th of October.
Nice.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's something we started properly for the first time last year, and our aim is it's a bit of a country fair.
Nice.
So it is research tours and talks and showcasing the garden, but we also invite friends to come and do things as well. So there'll be book sales from some horticultural authors and different tours by different groups doing interesting things with plants, because our aim with Burnley these days is it's the home of horticulture and everyone's welcome. So we
Fantastic.
Try to share it.
Yeah. So that'll be an annual event.
It is annual.
Moving forward.
Yeah, which is really exciting. So this is year two of it being an annual event.
Yeah, awesome. Terrific. And with Wattle Day coming up on the 1st of September, there's a next week's show. We've got Roger Elliott coming into the studio, and we're going to talk all things acacia.
Oh, wow.
But there are a couple
including
of...
why they shouldn't be called acacia.
Well, yes, we will talk about that.
Because Roger was there.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
We won't say anything.
Let's not ruin it for everybody.
The nomenclature and, the Wattle Wars. There are a couple of Wattle Day tours on the books. One at the Melbourne Gardens, Royal Botanic Gardens, Melbourne. That is 1st of September at from 10 till 2. There's a specific Wattle Walk of the Melbourne Gardens. Just jump on the Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria website for that. And I noticed that there was something happening in Greensboro. A free community event to come together to celebrate wattles in Banyule. So if you're a Banyule resident, your council is putting on a Wattle Day Walk event at 10:30 till 2:30 at Watermark Cafe in Greensboro.
Fantastic. Bit of
Wattle Day events as well.
I noticed a scarlet blaze in flower in the bot gardens on Thursday when I was down there too.
Did you?
Yes. There was a plant of it in full bloom.
Mine's just in bud.
Mm. Mm.
It's
a funny plant.
It's a funny plant. I think it's got a useful life of about 5 years.
Oh, yes, wow. It doesn't live all that long, does it?
No.
And I still object to the name.
Scarlet Blaze.
Yeah, it's not scarlet.
No, not nearly.
It's not nearly scarlet.
What colour would you call it?
I don't know. Red. It's more like tangerine. Tangerine blaze or something. I don't know. Yeah, but I mean, the name is a clever name, but it doesn't quite fit the colour of the plant, I don't think.
No, it's weak red.
Yeah, it is. It's dusty. It's not scarlet.
It's very dusty. And there are many plants that are dusty, and that is their strength, that they've got a beautiful colour that is dusty and is not loud and strong and... over the top.
Yeah.
So there's nothing wrong with being dusty.
Yeah. No.
That's a tragic story too.
Yeah.
That because that plant was discovered and then got murdered by people who found out where it was and just took too many cuttings from it.
Yeah, it was one of those chance...
At least it is in cultivation, though. So
that's right.
The original plant might be gone, but at least we have it.
The genetics is safe.
And has never been found again.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the thing about it. It was really
actually,
rare.
You could tell me. I was looking at it in the gardens the other day, and it's got its name on its big label, as they do, and it says Garden Origin.
I'm not so sure about that. It was discovered
in the wild, so it's not of Garden Origin.
It was discovered up the Melba Highway and off to the right.
Yeah. So I thought that was odd. I mean, it's certainly only in gardens now. But it was
definitely discovered in Murrindindi.
Yeah, it was in the wild.
Yeah, in Murrindindi.
I would have put wild, you know, Victorian wildflower.
And
or
maybe tell us the story that it was
one of those things that needs a big label telling the story. It needs an explanatory sign because people would walk past it, and if you're not aware that it's, you know, a complete colour break in the genus, you'd walk past, oh, that's pretty, and just keep going. Yeah. But, you know, it's got such an interesting story, it should
and
be told.
And how would you describe its story, John?
Well, discovered by some bushwalkers walking through the bush. So I think it's in Leprosa.
Leprosa.
That's an acacia Leprosa.
Yeah, noticed that, you know, here's this red flowered wattle. Look, I'm not exactly sure of the story. I think RBGV ended up protecting the genetics.
And said, we found this and this is where we found it. And they decided to keep it secret, which obviously was necessary.
The location of it,
And propped it.
What we might do, we might talk
I'll
to
talk about
the,
it next week.
Talk about it next week because Roger will be in the studio.
It's a really good story, so I think it's good if people can hear about it.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Because it is an extraordinary story.
It's an extraordinary story. Yeah, we'll carry that over to next week. That's our homework.
Okay, homework for next week. One of the things I should mention is if you want to send us a text, you can do that on 0488 809 055. However, you can't send us a photo because it goes through a computer and it won't take photos. If you want to send us a photo and ask us a question with a photo, you need to go to 3cr.gardening@gmail.com and that will come up for next week rather than this week. And, of course, if you want to ring us on 94190155.
With all those events on, we are right on the cusp of spring, aren't we?
Aren't we?
Totally.
And that's why I suggested have a pen. And I think because it's a lot to go through and I think we need people just to listen at this point and take notes.
Yeah.
Those garden fairs are fabulous. Bolobec, Gippsland and the Upper Yarra Valley, all of them are just fantastic to go. I mean, because you get the rare plant people there.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can go to Craig, you can go to Stephen, but there's not a lot of rare plant people readily available, and they all come together in those wonderful places.
Yeah, you've got access to some very special material at those plant fairs. I don't know, there's many, many growers. I think the Yarra Valley Plant Fair has 40 vendors.
Yep.
Something like that.
Probably half of those would be growers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. And you'll see quite a few of our people there always, which is excellent. And Treasured Perennials, which is Ben and Kerry, they're at all three of them. And they have wonderful plants and they don't sell them any other way. We've had a lovely message from Emma from Fernie Creek. Hi, Gin and team. What a great panel today. Thank you.
Oh, nice.
That's nice.
That is nice.
Yes. So we're talking about woody meadows, we're talking about botanic gardens, and, of course, the thing that links all these things are the friends groups. We've got two friends sales coming up, which are important.
Yeah, Cranbourne Friends on the 10th and 11th of October. The Growing Friends, and I can't recall the date for the Melbourne Growing Friends.
I have it right here, 17th and 18th of October.
And it's opportunity to tap into some, you know, some really interesting plant material, which are of the Melbourne Gardens and of the Cranbourne Gardens. Mm. We were just talking about the Growing Friends. I must shout out to Marianne, who has finished as the coordinator of the Growing Friends after 20 years. So
wow.
We've got a new... So thank you, Marianne, for all of your efforts over the last couple of years. But she sort of built the Cranbourne Friends, the Growing Friends, up to, you know, a really high level. They have two plant sales a year, and it's an opportunity to be able to access some plant material, which is... very unusual, stuff that's not commonly in cultivation, things that are of the Australian garden. You know, being a botanic garden, we've had that capacity to collect from all over the place. And the Growing Friends sales are the opportunity to actually take a little bit of the Cranbourne Gardens and a little bit of the Melbourne Gardens home with you. You know, access to some really interesting plant material. So a shout out to the Growing Friends. Kim McKee is taking on the role, and Kim will be fantastic. But Marianne did that role for 20 years, which is kind of remarkable.
It is amazing. I mean, people who give up their time to do something like that, they are champions.
They are. They sure are. And, you know, botanic gardens, there's a correlation between a botanic garden, which is doing interesting, relevant things, and then having a terrific relationship with the Friends group. There's a straight line correlation between effective Friends groups and botanic gardens that are doing some interesting work. It's an extension of the botanic gardens, and it's community outreach in that sort of front line community outreach for botanic gardens.
And the gardens, the botanic gardens in Burrendong, have they got a good Friends group?
Got a good Friends group, yeah. There's a organisation called the Association of Friends of Botanic Gardens, which I think Tim Entwistle is the patron of. And that's a sort of a clearinghouse for something like 62 botanic Friends gardens groups across Australia. Mm. Yeah, Friends of Botanic Gardens across Australia. So, yeah.
And would Burrendong, tell us about Burrendong Botanic Gardens.
Oh, Burrendong Botanic Gardens, it's a gem. It was the first of the dedicated Australian plant botanic gardens in Australia. So it predates the National Botanic Gardens only by a couple of years, but it was established 60 years ago, so it was in the 1960s. Incredibly ambitious agenda to be the national garden, and it was set up by a fellow called George Althoffer, who was cultivating Australian plants in the 1920s.
Uh-huh.
You know, this predates
wonderful
Thistle Harris and Edna Walling and, you know, that whole movement of looking at our Australian flora as being unique and something which is worthy of cultivation.
Yeah
he was a pioneer of Australian plant horticulture, and established this botanic garden in Wellington, which is halfway between Orange and Dubbo. Remarkable garden. Nearly 5,000 species
wow
of plants have gone through the books at Burrendong over the years, which is, you know, nearly a quarter of the Australia's flora at one point has been cultivated at the Burrendong Botanic Garden.
And some of it, I presume, survives there incredibly well and self-seeds.
Yeah. The issue with Burrendong is it was on Crown land in New South Wales, and funding was pulled to places like Burrendong about 15 years ago. So it's been in this steady decline ever since. So it's almost a little bit like the lost garden of Burrendong, because things like some of the wattles, some of the colonising plants, nature is rewilding itself in the garden. It's a little bit like an archaeological dig. You're pushing through all of these acacia pod arilifolias and weedy wattles. And you'll see a plant label of a plant that was planted in the 1970s, and you kind of look up and you can see the skeleton of it. It's a remarkable place.
Is it worth a visit?
Oh, absolutely it is. Absolutely it is. But there's a project called Burrendong Beyond 60, BBGA Beyond 60, and there's a rejuvenation which is happening to the beautiful old Burrendong Botanic Gardens. It's, you know, trying to get it back to, you know, its former glory.
And like so many gardens, without enough funding.
Yeah, funding's the issue. Yeah. The region, it's in a renewable energy hub. So there's a lot of money flowing back in for renewable energies, wind farms, solar farms and that type of thing. So there's some money flowing back into the region. And
it's a matter of trying to grab a bit of
Yeah, and Burrendong's being able to sort of, you know, work with some of the companies. So there's some money flowing back into the Burrendong Botanic Garden and Arboretum, which is a good thing.
Our wonderful emergency person, Greg, has just texted in saying that I read the number wrong for Cindy, and I did. Because I didn't put my glasses on, I'm very sorry.
Good on you, Greg. I should have picked that up.
You should have picked it up, nevertheless. So if you wish to send us a text, it is 0488 809 855. And I've read out 055. So 809 855. Thanks, Greg, and sorry about that. I also have another question. It's come in from Katie in Belgrave. Looking for a smaller magnolia. Could you contrast evergreen versus deciduous and give me some good varieties? Not Little Gem or Teddy Bear, as it'll get too big, thanks, and they're boring. She didn't say that, but I did.
I was going to say, how intuitive. Goodness me. Well, there's plenty of smaller growing deciduous magnolias. I mean, the stellata varieties, the hybrid Leonard Messel is not too big growing. And, of course, a lot of the magnolias are prunable as well, so you can sort of shape them a bit.
As long as you start early.
Yeah, and when you do shape them, you don't trim them over and turn them into a wobbly mushroom. You prune them with a little bit of finesse so that you keep the sort of elegance of the tree as well. So any of those sort of strappy leafed magnolias like that would be well worthwhile looking at. Most of the evergreen species magnolias tend to have a rather upright conical habit. Mm. And so although they don't grow terribly wide, they will get a little bit of height in them. And that's particularly sort of some of the Mycelia group that were part of the magnolias. So there's plenty of evergreens in those and many of them are highly perfumed. And I have to say height of something for me is very rarely an issue. It's the width of something that makes a big difference, particularly if you're in a smallish garden.
Sure.
Because the air's free. Yeah. I mean, white people get thingy about something that grows quite tall but stays slender, and then they'll go and plant a weeping elm or some damn thing that takes over their whole front garden. I don't get it. So, and again, you could what they call hat racket in America, and they do that with lots of evergreen trees there where when it gets too big, they actually cut the whole tree back to a stump, but they keep the actual outline of the tree. So at the base, if it's a conical tree, the branches that are left at the base will be wider, and then they'll come up to a point at the top. So they keep the actual shape of the tree, and it does look like a hat rack when they're finished pruning.
I've never heard of hat racking.
Haven't you heard of hat racking?
No.
The Americans do have some really evocative terms in gardening, which I love, like zonal denial, which I think is a fabulous term. I love it.
Hat racking and zonal. What is zonal denial?
Well, somebody is growing things or trying to that they shouldn't be growing in their particular zone.
Which you do
America's
all the time.
All zoned, and so they'll say they're zone 7 or zone 5 or whatever zone they are in America, and then they'll try and grow the plants from a different zone.
Yeah, I think I'm a zonal denialist.
Yeah, I think we all are. I love planting things that are sort of borderline and I may or may not get away with because it's all part of the fun of gardening. Why do you want to plant the predictable and the obvious? So any of those sort of Mycelia-y things, if you're looking for an evergreen one, so the whole range of them from China.
There's some very beautiful ones too.
Some of them have the most incredible perfumes.
Mycelia, well, Magnolia Figo.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just gorgeous.
Fabulous perfume, but that's almost a shrub more than a tree.
Yeah, sure.
It's much, much smaller than some and its flowers aren't big, blousy things like you expect from magnolias. They're comparatively small. Yep. But the perfume is, well, it's unique. Once you've smelt Mycelia or Magnolia Figo, as it is now, they call it the port wine magnolia because it has this sort of...
depth.
Yeah, and an almost sort of liqueur-y sort of smell, which is quite unusual for a flower, a very fruity sort of thing. And if I was a serious wine buff, I'd probably be able to tell you it smells of blackberries and burnt shag feathers or whatever. Yeah, and so there's a whole range of those as well. On a slightly larger scale, but still not terribly big, there is nothing wrong with a good Yulan, Magnolia denudata.
Oh, yeah.
Wonderful white tulip-shaped flowers, bare stems when it's in bloom, so you've got this fabulous outline of plant. And it also has a slightly upright form, so it can grow reasonably tall, but it's not an overly broad spreader. So there's a few ideas in magnolias.
There's a couple of stunning ones in flower at the moment at Craig's at Gentiana Nursery in Olinda, Katie, and you're quite close to that, so you might want to go and have a look and see.
Drop in there.
Those, they're beautiful. Mm. What is the difference between the deciduous and the evergreen.
Only the fact that one's evergreen, one's deciduous, really.
They well, don't specifically come from somewhere or whatever.
No, there's many evergreen Asian species, and particularly now that it's a much bigger genus. And then there's the North American ones. There's a number of evergreens from North America, not just grandiflora. I guess the main difference between the two groups is that the evergreen ones often have a later flowering period than some of the deciduous ones. The deciduous ones, I think, make more of a floral show in the garden because there's no leaves in the way.
Beautiful. I think that's what Craig's got out at his place at the moment. And they're absolutely fabulous, the deciduous magnolias.
I love them.
And the one that was bred in New Zealand, that really deep red one. That's
from the Jury family.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's some of those are out at the moment and they're nice. Beautiful. Yeah. Yes, there's Vulcan.
Yeah, my only issue with the deciduous magnolias is that I love my deciduous plants to do something again in the autumn.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Magnolias don't often do anything remarkable in the autumn. They tend to go a yellowy brown and shed their leaves, which I always find a bit of a disappointment.
Yeah,
yeah, but they're good leaves for breaking down and
they rot down nicely. They make good compost. But there's just so many out there. I know there's a number of new hybrid deciduous ones that are quite svelte as well.
Yeah.
So they're bringing out quite a range of
skinny sort of ones. They don't have to be hat-racked.
Yeah, they don't have to be hat-racked. No.
We're going to use that all the time.
I love that term. Yeah. I think it's a great term, and it's very descriptive of what they actually do.
Yeah, totally.
So, there you go.
I do think those red ones that were bred in New Zealand and they're around at the moment and they're in flower. So have a look at those too, Katie.
And some of the yellows. There's a few yellows around that they're not rich. Daffodil yellow, they're soft primrose yellows.
Like the champakas and things like that?
Yeah, but there's deciduous ones that were crossed between acuminata, which is one of the American deciduous magnolias, which is yellow, and denudata, which is white. Yeah. There's one out there called Elizabeth, which has tulip-shaped, pale primrose yellow flowers, and it can often have a second crop. So when it gets going, you'll get your main late winter crop and then you can get a secondary one later.
Nice. That sounds rather
nice. So, and it's slightly perfumed. So Elizabeth is worth looking out for.
And do they have them in your garden?
No, I do not. But my neighbour has a beautiful magnolia stellata.
Oh, no, I meant your Burnley garden.
Oh, yeah, they do. But I have to say I'm really naughty when it comes to plants. I tend to only learn them when I either need to use them or they're part of a project that I've been on. And magnolias so far have not been
they
one of those
been on the radar.
Things. But I have to say one of those horticultural terms I've been loving lately is trub. So those trees that are shrubs. So like for small gardens and things like that. So your magnolia that you were mentioning that was a shrub, maybe that's a trub.
It's a trub.
Yeah, it could be a trub. So actually, another term I love is a fedge.
Oh, nice.
Hang on, fedge, something in a hedge.
Hedge. Fence hedge.
Fence hedge. Oh, I love
that. Yeah, fedges. So they're basically, you have a fence and then you grow plant material through it and on it and you keep it trimmed back and so you can have something much narrower than a proper hedge and it's a fedge.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's wonderful because I think fedges are much better than nasty big fences.
Yeah, and they're much better sometimes than growing climbers on a fence.
I was just
going to
say, if you grew a climber on a fence, could that be a fedge?
It could be, depending on how you treat it.
Muhlenbeckia, maybe.
Yeah. Muhlenbeckia fedge.
Well, see, if you trim that up.
Muhlenbeckia are a perfect
example. On a cyclone fence trimmed up, you can keep it really skinny.
Yeah.
And it can look quite good. It's a lot of work. You've got to prune it regularly. Climbers on hedges, on fences can be lovely, except that many of them ruly on the top unless you keep them pruned.
The Muhlenbeckia, which is the wire vine for people who are wondering, and I suppose it's partly called the wire vine because it's grown on, it makes a wire fence look better, and it's also got a very, very, very small leaf which makes it very easy to prune.
Yeah.
And then the Chinese jasmine.
Yes, the Trachylus spermum.
That actually grows from the bottom, but virtually every other climber.
Yeah, they
just
run to
leaves
the top
the
and
bottom.
Stay up there.
Yeah,
and I don't like that look.
No.
Not as a fedge.
Yeah.
No. But then something that I've been thinking about playing with, and I've seen it done very well in Texas at a botanic gardens with native Texan climbers, is growing more than one climber at once. So you can kind of have the ones that do the thing and have foliage the whole way, but you can also celebrate the ones that run to the top for what they are.
Interplant.
Yeah.
I do that a lot. I love having several climbers going together. I think it's a really good way to do things.
Yeah.
Because you cover up some of the problems. Yeah, no, it's excellent.
I mean, climbers were a big, big part of the green wall, green infrastructure, urban cooling.
They are.
But they're challenging.
They are challenging, but I think the thing that we've found with research is they're far more adaptable. And it makes sense, doesn't it? Because they can be in a forest, densely shaded, and then the tree can fall down and they still have to be there kind of thing. Yep. But, you know, we've irrigated them with grey water and they're fine. You know, put them in super dense shade after being in full sun and they're fine. It's just managing the growth so they do what you want them to do. Yeah. That's the tricky bit.
They're like puppies. They're not just for Christmas.
And, I don't know, top couple of climbers for urban gardens? Pandorina in the mix?
Canarina has to be in
Pandorina
the mix.
Pandorina panorama is good because it does go to the top, but then it gets pendulous shoots. So as long as you've got that width for them to do their drapey thing, they're super awesome.
Yep.
But, I mean, really, Virginia creeper is so spectacular, and I'm really enjoying seeing it on pergolas where it becomes a roof and a curtain and a wall.
Dangles. Yes. I love dangles.
So beautiful.
Climbers that sort of just wrap themselves on themselves at the top look dreadful.
They do.
Virginia creeper with that droopy habit. It's actually a relative of that, the Chinese silver vein creeper, Parthenosis henryana.
Oh, that's
it's good. Shade tolerant, still colours in the shade. And in fact, in the shade, it gets a white vein down the centre of each leaflet. And when that turns in the autumn, you've got bright scarlet with white veins.
Super.
And I think it's one of the world's great climbers. Yeah. I just love it.
Yeah, lovely. And I actually have a question for you all, because when you start off one of these climbers, they're not necessarily that adhesive.
Yeah, take a bit, yeah.
Do any of you have tricks to stick it to something?
No, you don't. You lay it all on the ground and let it find its
really?
Own way.
Oh, wow.
I just lay them all on the ground and stick a rock against them so they can't move, and they find their own way. And they'll do that fairly quickly.
So go laterally first.
Yeah, and thinking about it, when you think about it, a climber will run up to the top of something quite quickly.
Yep.
But if you can start it by moving it sideways at the bottom, then when it does start to go up, it covers a bigger area.
Yeah, clever.
So that's what I would do.
Yeah, but doesn't work necessarily if you're trying to get it up a specific structure.
Oh, on a pergola and things, it's different. But if you wanted to grow up a fence, then that's how I would do it.
That'd be a perfect way to do it on a fence. But up, I mean, I think you've got to start with something. I mean, you have to be active as you started up a pergola, say. And you have to wind it. If you don't wind it, I mean, I've got a Lepidgeria and I've just had to wind it. Now it's got high enough that it's going on its own. And Lepidgerias are absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
So it's worth going.
It is. It's more the fence situation.
Yeah.
Because, the pergola, you can have wires, that makes sense. But when you've got a paling fence.
And can I make a little bit of advice or say something else to people? Don't use chicken wire and fine-gauged wires to run your climbers up, because when they start to get thicker stems, the wire starts eating into them. Mm. Just run a single strand of wire up with flat-haired galvanised clout so that it sits out off the structure just a tiny bit and wind it up that. And that will disappear inside the plant. It doesn't do any harm. But, yes, putting chicken wire around it not only is dangerous for the climber, but it looks awful.
Yeah, it does look,
it does
awful.
Look awful.
Whereas that's when the Muhlenbeckia complexa comes into its own, of course, because that is the wire vine and it is specifically for growing on a wire hedge.
It's hard to go past the Muhlenbeckia as a...
Especially if you then put a clematis over it.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. And, you know, even the star jasmine, it's hard to go past that as a...
Well, the thing with the star jasmine is it does go from the bottom and most of them don't.
Hmm. Yeah.
And there are alternatives within the star jasmine. Everybody goes for the classic one, but there's any number of cultivars.
Are there really?
So, okay. Yeah, there's variegated leafed ones. There's one I've got. There's two main species, Asiatica and Jasminoides, which are commonly available. I've got a juvenile form of Asiatica that I bought back from America many years ago that has a really skinny leaf with a white vein down the centre.
Nice.
It's supposedly non-flowering. It stays as a completely juvenile form. And I've got one called Lucida, which is a softer shade of green. It's a more appley green instead of the really dark green. And that's a really
handsome thing.
Yeah. Mm. So, you know, I was going to say you can look out for them, but you probably can't find them anywhere.
Well, you can find them at Dicksonia Rare Plants.
Yeah, people come up to my place, I can offer them a couple of these other forms. And I don't know, if there's something that's different than the obvious and predictable, I'll often opt for that because I just don't want the obvious and predictable in my garden.
Starting to see a lot of Aphanopetalum, the gum vine.
Yeah, that's and that is a beautiful fedge as well.
Yeah.
So at the Burnley ramp entrance, that was grown to sort of hide the balustrade there, and it's stunning.
Doing a great job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which so one? Repeat which one that is?
It's Aphanopetalum, but I think the common name is gum vine. It's an Australian native rainforest.
Quite a vigorous vine.
Yeah, yeah, it is quite vigorous.
Yeah, and it's got a beautiful, really shiny leaf. It's stunning.
Black green, dark green. Yeah.
Hardenbergia can be a problem. Yes. It'll break a fence. Yeah. Which
most
can be a problem.
Will.
Yeah.
It can be a real problem in a smallish garden because it'll I've seen it break picket fences.
And it does run to the top.
And it always runs to the
top. Unstuffed mattress at the top is the way I describe it.
Whereas I've got it and it hasn't gone up anything.
Yeah,
and
okay.
It's made a lovely mound. At the moment, it's a mound of white flowers.
Gorgeous.
And it's beautiful.
I mean, because I'm slack and I didn't put a framework in for it, I actually Hardenbergia comptiana growing up my Indigofera.
Right.
So the combination of the two types of like wisteria-like flowers is quite beautiful.
So what happens when the Indigofera
I'll unwind it at some point. But like I'm just enjoying the vibe. A bit like your accidental ablutilon kind of mix.
Yeah, it's sometimes the serendipity of things can be quite good.
Absolutely wonderful. Yes, yes.
I, as a climber or a sort of a rambler or a Herbertia scandens, that's a useful plant.
Yeah, some
relatively
really
common.
Actually.
Oh, there's some gorgeous ones, yeah.
Great genus.
Yeah.
I've got one to ask about. I have got the native passion fruit.
Passiflora cinnabarina.
Yeah, and I've had it in one bed, happily, looking nice, doing things, and now I've got it in three beds.
Yeah, it's weedy.
I think it is weedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Along with that other one, the Solia.
Yeah.
Which
well,
that
certainly
yeah,
can go with
that is
the weedy. Soya.
Mm. That's beautiful.
Beautiful, though.
John walked around my garden and said, you've got to take that out.
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
but Passiflora cinnabarina, I reckon that's got huge weed potential.
So
yeah.
I need to take it out?
Yeah.
Oh, I would.
Or manage it.
Or manage it, yeah.
But like the Herbertia scandens, that's really nice too because that is one that stays to the bottom, but it doesn't get super big. So growing that at the bottom of other climbers is also really cool. Mm.
A multi-species fedge.
Yeah.
Well, I think
we're really getting into this, aren't we?
The small garden special.
And what was the other one, Claire?
A trub.
Yeah, trub.
It's a similar vibe to what Stephen was saying, going to Michael Wright's garden, where, you know, they're encouraging people in small gardens in England to plant shrubs so they get some kind of tree canopy and structural diversity in the tiny gardens.
And it's becoming so much more important for them to have shade than previously. And Q has said that it's not going to plant any English oaks anymore. It's just too hot. And the Wildlife Trust, no, it's not the Wildlife Trust, that's here. But
National Trust?
No, there's a specific organisation just to try and make local plants be planted. And they're totally horrified that Kew doesn't want to plant any oaks. And Kew's just said there's
well,
no point.
English oaks. Yeah.
English oaks. Yeah. He said, we'll plant them at Wakefield. Anywhere in the West they will grow, but they will not grow in London. And Rowans. And, you know, there's a whole list of things. In the 22 drought, which is just like the one they've had this year, they lost 600 trees in Kew.
Wow.
And this, I was in London 6 weeks ago and it was vile. Mm.
Brown.
It was just so hot. We couldn't breathe. We couldn't go out. We couldn't do anything. I couldn't sleep in my bedroom. It was just, and of course I've got lots of friends in London, having lived there for 20 years, not one of them has got cooling. They don't even know what cross-ventilation is, you know. They've just, and then I went home through Zurich because I didn't want to take any flights through the Middle East, so I picked up my long flight in Zurich. Now Zurich, Switzerland, everything in Switzerland is quite posh. Of course, the airport's quite posh. It was unbearable because it wasn't cooled. It was boiling.
Yeah.
I know Peter Symes used to work at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Melbourne, one of the global leaders in sustainable landscapes.
As an expert.
He's picking up quite a lot of work in the UK around irrigation and irrigation design. And
oh, that's great.
Climate proofing. And, you know, there's a strong awareness of climate change in the Northern
Hemisphere. Well, I know Richard took him over to Kew, and that was important.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that, though, because I've been reflecting on this. You know, you see on your Instagram posts all the English gardeners all of a sudden using mulch, like it's this amazing thing that never existed before.
How novel.
But, you know, and they took so long to go peat-free for their potting mix, and I feel like they just didn't bother to come and say, you guys haven't used peat for years and years and years, how did you do it, and start from there rather than reinventing the wheel. So I'm glad to hear that, John, because I do kind of sometimes think, is it reverse cultural cringe? Where they go, we can't go to the colonies and ask them.
It may well be. I mean, they are very, they have a long history in horticulture, of course, over there, and they can be quite conservative. So maybe they just don't want to learn from us. But, you know, we have been hot for a long time. So
and know about it.
And we know.
Well, my friend Fiona who lived the street up from me, she moved to Dorset years ago, and she's been mulching ever since she moved there. And for years they've thought she's potty.
One of those wacko nutty type characters.
Yeah, from the colonies.
Yeah.
But now her garden's looking fantastic and their gardens are all looking vile. And she says, well, I've told you, you've just got to mulch. Mm. Now, Christine from Mount Druin, wants to know about earwigs on passion fruit vines, as we were talking about passion fruit vines. Anybody got any? Oh, she's on the phone.
Oh,
silly
phone.
Me. I wasn't looking in the right place.
All right.
Earwigs.
I mean, the only thing I know about earwigs is from dahlias.
Yeah. Are you there, Christine?
No, you haven't got her through somehow.
No, I've missed her. Well, let's talk about her problem.
Earwigs.
And maybe she'll ring us back.
I know that you can trap them and then dispose them, and things like putting an upturned terracotta pot full of straw or shredded newspaper seems to work. But
so capture them and then do something nasty
with them. Christine, that you don't tell anyone.
Yes.
Oh,
hello.
I found her. Oh, good on you, Christine.
Oh, hello there. Hi.
Can you speak closer to the phone? We can't hear you fantastically.
Yeah, sure.
That's
sorry.
Yep.
Hello, how are you?
We're good, thank you. So tell me, what is your passion fruit problem?
Well, I'm dealing with frost right now, so I've covered them with some light netting to discover that I have baby earwigs all through the netting this morning when I got up. I don't know how to get rid of them.
Well, take the netting off immediately.
Yes, and how do I treat them? Like, I've taken the netting away. But luckily for me, I've found out what's actually been eating them.
Well, Claire, you were talking about a trap?
Yeah, trapping them. So, you know, obviously they like to go where it's dark and cool. So making something like a terracotta pot upturned or a pot upturned with shredded damp newspaper, and then you can trap them in there and get rid of them in the morning. I think half orange shells
Under those. The issue is, if you've got a passion fruit, even if you can find something you could spray with, and to kill earwigs with a spray, you need something pretty potent.
So don't do it because you won't
want to eat your passion fruits because you'll have some sort of systemic insecticide.
But they might particularly have been attracted to the cover, and once that's gone, you might have less of a problem.
And they will be cyclical. I mean, these things, they come and be a real pest for a while, but then they'll disappear again.
And maybe the birds, without the net, the birds will come and do it for you.
Yeah,
thank you.
And if you have got a lot of them trapped under the net, try and use that as some way of collecting them all up and, I don't know, pour hot water over them or salty water or something like that and have a bit of a blood
but
bath
I
with
do,
them.
They will definitely go into newspaper underneath pots. Yep. Mm. So that
is cardboard, they will go under
those sort of things.
I can see a reference here for getting a container with vegetable oil and a splash of soy sauce.
Nice.
going out for Chinese. Yeah.
There you go. You can feed them before you kill them.
And any of those sort of water traps or liquid traps, you'd place them on at ground level with the pot sunk in.
So well, get rid of them all together.
Oh, is that Christine?
Sorry, Mr.
Sorry, will it get rid of these aerids altogether? Because I seem to have thousands of them.
Control isn't necessarily complete obliteration. Mm-hmm. It's about getting them to manageable numbers. So I don't think you could aspire, or you could aspire, but it would be challenging to get rid of every single one. But it's about getting the balance right. So
okay,
and just doing it continually for the next month or two.
But rolled up paper.
Thank you.
That old school, that seems to work pretty well.
Awesome. Thank you paper so much, guys. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Christine. Bye-bye. Bye. Yes. They are just there, but I wonder if they were attracted by her throwing something over.
Yeah, possibly.
Because it would provide that the sort of thing they like.
Yeah, nice and cool and shady.
Yeah, yeah, that's so right. So getting rid of it might be a really very good idea. Good morning, plant team. As a friend of Kyneton Botanic Gardens, I'll have my garden open on Friday the 11th and Saturday 12th of September. I know who this is from. This will be part of the Open Gardens offerings in our annual Daffodil Festival. Although too early to visit my garden to see it in full growth, it'll still be very, very interesting. So part of the Kyneton Daffodil Festival, which I haven't got on my list, which is shocking, and I'll put it on the list. So that's the Friday the 11th and Saturday the 12th of September.
Okay.
So that will be, and that is Margot McDonald's garden.
Oh, good on you, Margot.
It's a lovely spot where Margot is out there.
It's beautiful. Yeah. And she's got beautiful views around her, you know. It's a really stunning spot.
And it's another example that I think Margot's probably talking about the Friends of the Kyneton Botanic Garden, who have been the sort of the stalwart supporters of the garden for many, many, many years. And you would argue that if it were not for the Friends of the Kyneton Botanic Gardens, that the refocus on the Kyneton Botanic Gardens, it probably wouldn't have happened.
Well, they probably wouldn't have got rid of the caravan park out of the back.
All of that.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. All of that. And it's important. And also the money that she raises is all going to the Friends.
And, you know, it does speak to the role of Friends groups as
support.
And advocates.
Advocates, yes, that's the word we need.
I can't recall the year that it happened, but the 150th year of the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne.
That's right, yes, I remember that very well. They were out there setting up gifts to a lot of the botanic gardens all around the state.
But it was conditional. It was a project. They grew on all of these really interesting plants that were specific to individual gardens. So, you know, a selection of a cypress for the Williamstown Botanic Garden, that type of thing. So unusual plant material distributed to regional botanic gardens. But it was conditional on the fact that the garden had to establish a friends group. And the purpose of the friends group were community watchdogs, advocates for the garden, and keep the bastards honest.
Well, keep them focusing.
Maintain the focus on this is a botanic garden, significant botanic garden in the network of botanic gardens in our environment. Mm. And the purpose of the Friends group is to hold council to account in many respects. So it was a little bit of an adversarial model. And it sometimes can slip into an adversarial model. It is one of the functions of a Friends group is advocacy and holding to account the councils that are managing the gardens.
Yeah, and I mean it's fair to say at Burnley, you know, a lot of the beautiful things in the garden, like the orchard gates and the big sugar gum table and all of those things, were actually from fundraising from the Friends. I mean, you know, within the university, those kind of things, they're nice to have so they wouldn't actually ever end up in those gardens. Yeah. But they're a beautiful addition and really uplift Burnley.
Yeah.
And they provide, the Friends, there's fun. You know, the guides offer a huge amount to the gardens where they take tours. You just, when you go to a garden and you go with a guide, you just find out things that are fascinating that you wouldn't notice when you wander through on your own.
Yeah.
And that's very much to do with Friends.
You know, you think about the Friends of the Geelong Botanic Gardens and Stephen, your patron to the Friends of the yep. Geelong Botanic Gardens. You know, a long-standing, the amount of money, just money that they've raised and poured into projects at the Geelong Botanic Gardens, incredibly significant. And all of the guided tours and that sort of face-to-face interpretation and guiding, all done by the Friends.
Yeah.
They're a remarkable group, and the Geelong Botanic Gardens is celebrating its 175th year this year.
Wow.
Which is pretty impressive.
175 years of the Geelong Botanic Garden, and there's a bit of a shindig in October.
Yes, which I'm hoping to be at, but anyhow, we'll see how we go.
See how you go.
Yeah.
I am back to magnolias. I have a port wine magnolia that's as tall as my house. Mm-hmm. Really advanced tree that I inherited with an old house I bought in the Dandenong Ranges.
Oh, what a tree.
I always hear and read that they're smaller, but mine is massive.
Must be old.
Yeah.
It must be.
But having said that, if it's only the size of the house, it's still a shrub.
4 metres.
No, I suspect she might have a two-storied house.
Well, even if she's got a two-storey house, if it's branchy all the way to ground level, I always think of a tree as something you've got to be able to walk under if it's going to be a proper tree.
Whereas a tree is anything taller than me.
And you're not terribly
tall. No, I'm not terribly tall.
I think on a national tree, there was a discussion on this show about, you know, what constitutes. Have you got a definition for a tree?
Because I studied botany, I tend to use that anything taller than 2 metres kind of thing.
But, woody?
Yeah, woody, taller than 2 metres. But somebody actually came up to me the other day and said that they've added to that if it's multi-stemmed, it's a shrub.
Oh.
And if it's, but then I'm like, well, how do you deal with the mallees?
Yeah,
they're still trees,
yeah.
And they get big enough to be trees.
Yeah.
I don't think the number of trunks really denotes a tree.
No.
But for me, a tree is always something, though, that does have that sort of sense of being up in the air above you. And so if a tree comes right down to ground level, sometimes it doesn't have that same feeling of a tree, if you get my drift.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's one of those things, it's like most terms we use in horticulture. I mean, what really is a weed? You know, there's lots of terms we use and we just use them blithely and accept everybody.
Well, every time I see my garden at the moment is yellow. Guess what I've got in my garden?
Oxalis.
Everywhere.
Gorgeous looking flower.
It is actually quite stunning.
Anybody who can get oxalis growing their garden like that in Britain is absolutely thrilled.
Mm.
And I think it's a disgusting weed.
Although, the good thing about it is it dies down in the summer and leaves room for everything else to do
absolutely.
Its thing.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
It's up and doing its thing at this time of the year. When you see it through the vineyards up in sort of Rutherglen area and what have you, where there's acres and acres of it, it actually doesn't do any harm to the vines. You know, and it's doing its thing when the vines are dormant. The vines come out, the oxalis disappears. It's a weed, but it's in some ways nowhere near as nasty as something that's evergreen.
So why is it good for the vines?
It's not good for the vines, but it doesn't hurt them.
No, it doesn't hurt
There's
them.
No sort of interaction between the two groups of plants.
I've got rue in my vines at the moment, which I think all that poo will be very useful.
Yes. So some of the weedy plants out there are weedy by definition of who's looking at them.
Absolutely.
And, you know, other people.
Then there is real weeds.
Well, there's,
that escape
there's
to
environmental
the bush.
Weeds and, you know, and serious agricultural weeds and what have you. But a lot of things people see as weedy are just plants with a zest of life.
Yeah.
and they've just given up managing them properly.
Now, we've got some more messages. We've got one which won't be of any interest to other listeners, but I'm very pleased. George has said that he has received his package of Madeira cranesbill seeds, which was part of something that he was getting from when we were doing our...
Oh, that's right, when we were doing that one with Merrill.
Merrill, yeah. Yes.
Excellent.
So I'm very pleased that George has got those. Kerry sent in from Treasured Perennials has sent in that she's got Muhlenbeckia, so I suspect they will be selling Muhlenbeckia at all those three sales, so that's good because Muhlenbeckia is excellent.
Yeah, gorgeous plant.
So I'm very pleased about that. And there's a couple of other messages. No, the other direction, please. Thank you. Oh, there's a wonderful art exhibition at the Cultural Medicine, the Art of Indigenous Healing at the University of Melbourne Medical History Museum.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah, and if I can make a plug, there's an exhibition till the 5th of September that's called The Measured Garden at the Potter Museum at the Parkville campus, And that is a collaboration between MAPCO and Museums and Collections at the university. But it's an exhibition of the artists in residence at Burnley that have worked on the Arts Precinct plant trials with Dean Shriek. So
that sounds great.
It's fantastic because it's how both of the artists, Keg D'Souza and Francis Carmody, worked alongside Dean as he was collecting data on the plant trials, and they've interpreted it in their own way. And there's some of the Burnley archives on display as well, so it's worth a look.
Sounds fabulous. Excellent.
Where was that again?
That is at the Potter Museum at the Parkville campus, not the NGV Potter, which is confusing everyone. So on Swanson Street.
It has Parkville. A lot of excellent things that...
Oh, yeah, and if you haven't seen Nanwangal, The Art of the Eucalypt, that has a longer end time. It's closer to the end of the year, but that is a beautiful exhibition. And the Measured Garden is in a room alongside that exhibition. So it's a brilliant morning or afternoon out.
And that's also at Potter?
Yeah, also at Potter.
Mm.
So Potter at Melbourne University is actually really quite exciting. So I recently visited, this is from Susie, who is one of our producers. I recently visited a lovely nursery and garden on the outskirts of Geelong in the Barrabool Hills. Cottage Farm Perennial Nursery at Barrabool Road, Gnawea. Open Thursday to Monday. It's very easy to get to via the Geelong Freeway and a beautiful drive-through series in the Barrabool Hills.
Lovely.
With a delicious homemade afternoon tea in the cafe. So that sounds absolutely awesome. And for some reason, the two double passes for the Clivia show are still available. So if you want to give us a ring on 94190155, you can get a double pass for the Clivia show, which is on the, put the glasses on so you don't get it wrong, on September the 19th, 10 till 3. And they have amazing things at that Clivia show. They really are very, very, very competent.
Let Lots me of just. Clivias.
I probably do mean Clivias. they have demonstrations of propagating. They've got all sorts of seeds. They've got them from South Africa, China, from Queensland that are generally unavailable to the public. So that makes it. And they've so many colours. They've got green, peaches, dark and pale yellows, reds, Picardy, versicolour. There's so many different Clivias. Mm. Clivias available. And Stephen, you have?
I just wanted to quickly talk about another genus of plants that I have a great soft spot for, and this will create some controversy about pronunciations as well. The cyclamen. I've got a wee story, and I'll be as quick as I can. There was a gentleman in the Alpine Garden Society up at the Dandenongs many, many years ago, Philip Gordon. And what the Gordons didn't know about plants was not worth knowing. I mean, they were really knowledgeable bulb and alpine growers and what have you. And I can remember one of the very early meetings I went to, feeling slightly out of my depth, and Philip Gordon got up and he said, "Now, I've been doing some research on this business about whether we should be saying cyclamen or cyclamen," he said. And he said, "You know, it comes from the Greek word kukul for a circle, because that's how the stems go as they bring the seed pods down to the ground. And so maybe we should be saying kuklamen." And I could not stop myself. And I leapt up from the audience and said, "Philip, that's fantastic. The next time I'm bikukling past, I'll come and have a look at your collection." Of course, he had no sense of humour. The rest of the place broke up. I think it was one of my best one-liners ever.
Yeah, it was a good one.
Yeah, but anyhow, I say cyclamen. And now is a really good time in the genus, because there's crossover at this time of the year, because the little winter flowering one, cyclamen coombe, is in full flight at the moment and looking absolutely stunning with its little round kidney-like leaves and its chubby little flowers from white to deep carmine. But some of the spring ones are coming out at the same time as well. And we have cyclamen libanoticum from the Lebanon, which actually has a peppery smell to the...
Peppery?
It's not a real perfume. It's a weird sort of scent. Have a sniff of that one. Oop, John, there you go. And the other one that's out at the moment is cyclamen repandum, which you see growing wild on Corsica and in France. And it has a violet perfume. And I can remember driving around Corsica, and it was a warm day, and you'd have the windows down, and you'd suddenly get this belt of perfume would come in through the driver's side window.
From the cyclones.
Yeah, from them. And you'd pull over, and you'd get out, and you'd stand up onto the edge of the bank on the side of the road, and there'd be fields of them in flower out there under the chestnuts. And I just love them. I think they're, again, they're what Virginia was talking about earlier. They're summer dormant, most of them. There's only one summer growing cyclamen. The rest all go dormant in the summer, so you don't have to water them or think about them much in the summer. And in fact, the only thing about them is you've just got to remember where they are, because when they're dormant for such a long time, I see the natural enemy of the cyclamen as the garden fork. You know, and so it's a matter of having them somewhere where they're left alone. So the more you can leave them alone, the better. Most of them will self-seed and colonise. The ants pick up the seeds and wander off with them because they've got a sticky coating on them. So they'll sometimes germinate in completely unexpected places in the garden. I've had them come up under the barge boards under my shed and all sorts of weird places where cyclamen will come up. And
in your lawn.
And in my lawn. I get them all over the place and in the driveway. It's amazing where they come up. But they're never offensive. They're never an issue. And drifts of them in the garden. And if you do collect the species, I mean, you've got Hedropholium that flowers seriously well in the autumn. It's sort of the start of the season. So, and it often starts in January, depending on the year. Then you go into Coom. Then you go into the spring ones, which are Pseudibericum, Libanoticum, and Rapandum. And there's the one summer flowering one, which is Cyclamen purpurescens. So you can actually cover the whole year.
Amazing.
And they've got the most wonderful leaves.
Oh, the once you've started collecting them, it's only a small genus. I think it's about 25 species, some of which are not available commercially anyway, like Cyclamen somaliensis, which I believe is only in the Gutenberg Botanic Gardens. Okay. They discovered it only a decade or so ago in Somalia. All the rest come from around the Mediterranean basin.
And there's one in Somalia.
Yeah. How discovered amazing. Completely unexpectedly. And it's related to Cyclamen persicum, which is the one that's the pot grown one that everybody buys. So it's a small genus, but there's so much diversity in the foliage. You can get pewter leafed ones and highly variegated leafed ones. And they're not variegations in the sense of a virus induced variegation. This is natural variegation.
Patination.
Patination. Yeah. And you can then become obsessed by the different leaf forms as well as the different
flowers. Absolutely. I think that's very easy.
Oh, God. And they're so beautiful. And doesn't matter how small your garden is, you should have 3 acres of them.
And, Stephen, on that, so, I mean, I have them in my new bulb bed under the Acer. Do you think you could grow these in, a garden that has winter shade, summer sun, as a, you know, gap filler amongst all the perennials that all...
Oh, you definitely could. In fact, mine come up of their own accord in just that sort of habitat quite regularly. I've got them growing under my hedges, and that's often an area of the garden that you can't get anything much
that's
going.
Nice.
The cyclamen grow under my Escalonia hedges and all that sort of stuff really well.
That's really nice.
In fact, I'm encouraging them. So there's a mass of different uses for them. And unlike most bulbous plants, I mean, they're not a bulb, they're actually a corm or a tuber. But unlike most bulbous plants, you've got great foliage, you've got really good flowers, and you've got length of flowering period as well. I mean, your average daffodil is about a fortnight. Most cyclamen will flower for 2 to 3 months each, and then you've got several months of good foliage on either side. So, and because there's some that will flower all year round, you quite literally can have them all the time. And they are just the most exquisite group. And they're elegant and they're dainty and, I don't know, they've just got an incredible charm about them.
They sure do.
And I just think it's one of the world's great bulbous genera.
Well, I think they look just, when you see them where they've really managed to take over in a garden, they look wonderful, just wonderful. Yeah. They're very beautiful.
What was the peppery one?
That's Libanoticum.
That's genuinely peppery.
Yeah, it is. It's a really weird, well, you can't really call it a fragrance or a perfume, but it's got a weird smell about it, which is interesting. But it's one of the few that has very little diversity in the species.
Okay.
So the flowers are always that soft shell pink. The foliage is almost always the same patination. I've never come across one that looks any different from the others, whereas some of them have enormous genetic variation within the species. And there's so much difference in them that it's, yeah, they become collector's items in their own right.
Have you ever worked out a combination where you've got two herbaceous perennials, one summer dormant, one winter dormant, and the two, mixing the two together?
Oh, yes, you can. Yeah, I've done that with a number of bulbs. I often use bulbs under my perennials. So if they're winter growing, late winter, early spring flowering bulbs, they're generally doing their stuff before the perennials get underway. I haven't done it for a few years, but I used to plant tulips in my asparagus bed.
Okay, for that reason.
Yeah, because I could get a whole bed full of tulips before the asparagus really got underway. Mm. I tried it in the rhubarb bed, but unfortunately the rhubarb tends to hold up too much foliage in the winter. So the purple tulips I put in with the rhubarb sort of worked, but not really well because there was too much foliage there in the way. But I love things that have that summer dormancy, and it's not always just bulbs. I mean, there's plenty of perennials that go down in the summer that can do something interesting in the winter. And my top candidate for that's the giant fennel, Ferula communis, the Mediterranean, because it's a metre high and wide at the moment. It'll send up a flower spike about 3 metres tall, and as soon as we get our first warm weather in the spring, it'll die down and disappear, and the other perennials will come up and take over.
It's interesting though with that cyclamen coombe. We've got that in the Arts Precinct plant trials, and we're growing it in scoria, so green roof substrate. It has been evergreen.
Yeah.
So it hasn't, yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Really weird. Yeah. It's got smaller leaves and it's really prostrate.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's stayed evergreen.
How about that?
Oh dear. That so there's a lot research. To learn about some of these plants.
That is research. That is wonderful. Now I've got a couple of quick messages. On the frost, our wonderful Emma, who hasn't been in for a while because she's just had a baby, says for the passion fruit, to avoid the frost on your passion fruit, wake up early and get out and water the foliage before the sun hits it, and that will stop the cells bursting.
Yep.
So that's a very good piece of advice.
That's a hot tip.
Mm.
Yep.
And, of course, you see places on the western, going out west, where they do water first thing in the morning.
Mm.
You know, they've got the whole thing set up, and it's not about irrigation. It's actually about frost avoidance.
Yep. Yeah, it all works really well unless your hoses are frozen.
have you experienced
I've had that.
You turn the tap on, nothing comes out.
Yeah, nothing comes out. Yes, I've had that happen. And then you think, oh, well, that doesn't work then.
That is absolutely particularly difficult.
Yeah.
That's cold.
There was one thing I thought I should mention because somebody has asked me. I am doing a walk next Sunday, the 30th, in the Botanic Gardens at 1:15. And some people have asked if I'll actually announce my next walk so they can join me.
Yeah, well,
lovely.
Good.
And with any luck, it'll be a stunningly beautiful day and we'll all enjoy it. Well, I think we might almost come to winding up. Mm-hmm. This has been a busy morning with lots of bits coming in online. It's been lovely. Thank you, Stephen.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, John.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Fabulous. Thanks, Virginia.
Very good, Claire. And John, can you just quickly tell us what's happening next week?
Yeah, next week on the show we're talking about wattles, as in acacia. So it's a bit of a deep dive into the genus acacia. And part of our homework was to talk about Scarlet Blaze, but yes. We'll also talk about the name.
Yeah.
Because there were some interesting discussions around the name about 10 years ago.
Yeah, I reckon the South Africans will win in the end. I'm on their side with this one. Oh, yeah. Laws and precedents.
Absolutely. Yeah. But is there any chance of it being revisited?
Well, anything in nomenclature can be revisited. Yeah. I mean, it's all man-made anyway, so we can discuss it again and say, oh, I think we were wrong last time, or we need to.
And who have you in the show with you next week?
I actually can't recall. Adrian Keane.
Oh, nice.
Adrian's coming in. And there was one other person. I'm sorry for that person because it's just not front of mind.
Well, it'll be a wonderful show.
Yeah.
And so, there are wattle walks all around. Look up wattle walks as well.
But what do we do in the meantime? Sorry. I can't help myself.
You absolutely can't.
Oh, dear.
Well, thank you, everybody. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Stay tuned now for alternative news.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.